2 Samuel 14:1 through 15:12. The eighth talk in a series on 2 Samuel was presented by David Crabtree on April 25, 2010 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2010. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
We'll be looking at 2 Samuel chapter 14. Last week in chapter 13, David's oldest son, his firstborn, Amnon, was in love with his half-sister, Tamar, who was the daughter of David by a different wife, and he ended up raping her. Absalom, the brother of Tamar, the full brother of Tamar, the half-brother of Amnon, was very upset by the event. David was angry because of what his son had done, but David didn't take any action. Absalom waited 2 years, waited for the right opportunity, and the right opportunity came along that he was able to put together. He invited all of the king's sons to come to the sheep shearing and the party afterwards. He instructed his servants to provide Amnon with lots of alcoholic beverage. He got drunk, and when he was drunk, then the servants jumped him and killed him. Absalom then took off for Geshur, which is a kingdom to the north of Israel, to the northeast of Israel. That's where his mother had come from. And his grandfather was the king at the time, the king of Geshur. So Absalom fled there and sought refuge there for a period of time. And that's where the action picks up in chapter 14. I'm going to take this in smaller chunks because it's a little tricky to work through. So this will be broken up a little bit, but I think that will work better. Now Joab, the son of Zeruiah, perceived that the king's heart was inclined towards Absalom. So Joab sent to Tekoa and brought a wise woman from there and said to her, "Please pretend to be a mourner and put on mourning garments now, and do not anoint yourself with oil, but be like a woman who has been mourning for the dead many days. Then go to the king and speak to him in this manner." So Joab put the words in her mouth. Joab apparently has been lobbying on behalf of Absalom being reunited with David. And as the narrative, as the narration continues, I think it becomes clearer that that's what Joab has been doing. And he has noticed that there has been a bit of a change in David's attitude, and he wants to take advantage of that. My translation says the king's heart was inclined toward Absalom. The inclined toward is in italic in my translation because that's not actually in the text, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. But apparently, David's has had a bit of a change of heart. He is no longer as intent on tracking down Absalom and bringing him to account for what he has done. Joab notices that, and Joab wants to bring about a reconciliation. Now, as we continue in the narrative, I think it's clear that Joab is not driven by a particular attachment to Absalom. So apparently his motivation is more political rather than personal. I think that he's afraid that Absalom will be able, from Geshur, to mount some kind of threat to Israel proper. And in order to forestall that, he would like to have a reunification of David with Absalom and have reconciliation. So Joab comes up with an idea, with a plan, and it's a plan a la the prophet Nathan. Remember back a couple of chapters after David had committed adultery with Bathsheba, Nathan came to David and told this story that depicted someone doing something that was akin to what David had done, but it wasn't readily apparent that it was akin to what David had done. And it's about a rich man and a poor man. Poor man has a ewe, that a sheep that is the family favorite, and the rich, and it's really all that he has. The rich man has a guest that's coming, and he wants to serve his guest something special, but he doesn't want to give up anything that he has, so he takes the ewe from the poor man. And at the end of the story, David is outraged, and Nathan says, "And that is you. You're the one that did that." And David then recognizes the similarity and confesses his guilt. Joab now wants to pull a similar kind of accomplishment. He has recruited a woman from Tekoa. Tekoa is south of Bethlehem, not too far south of Bethlehem, but way south of Bethlehem. So it's in Judea, and that's David is from the tribe of Judah, so there would be a kinship there. But it's not close enough to Bethlehem that David would be likely to know this woman. So he's probably going to feel some kinship, but he doesn't know her. It describes her as a wise woman, and the role that Joab is going to have her play is going to require her to be pretty clever. And that's probably why he selected her. The plan involves her pretending to be in mourning. So he tells her how he's supposed to dress, how she's supposed to behave, etc., so that she looks like someone who has been in mourning for a period of time. And then it says that Joab said, "Go to the king and speak to him in this manner." And then so Joab put the words in her mouth. This is a little unusual for an Old Testament narrative. In an Old Testament narrative, what you expect is the king says to the messenger, "Take this message to Fred. Fred, go to the store and buy some milk." And so the messenger goes to Fred and says, "Fred, go to the store and buy some milk." That it is repeated both times, and typically it's repeated word for word the same. And that's what you expect in an Old Testament narrative. In this case, Joab's words to the woman are not recorded, and I think there are two reasons for it. One is, it couldn't have been all spelled out by Joab, because this isn't a speech, it's a dialogue. And what she says is interaction with David. So Joab couldn't tell her everything to say, because he doesn't know exactly how David is going to respond. And the other is, if it had been all laid out here, it would have ruined the suspense that's coming up. The way that this is going to unfold is interesting. So Joab has apparently told her the overall scheme. She's supposed to go to David, and she's supposed to present this scenario and bring him to the place where he sees the wrongness of the way that he is dealing with Absalom. Next section. "Now when the woman of Tekoa spoke to the king, she fell on her face to the ground and prostrated herself and said, 'Help, O king.' And the king said to her, 'What is your trouble?' And she answered, 'Truly, I am a widow, for my husband is dead. And your maidservant had two sons, but the two of them struggled together in the field, and there was no one to separate them. So one struck the other and killed him. Now behold, the whole family has risen against your maidservant, And they say, hand over the one who struck his brother, that we may put him to death for the life of his brother whom he killed, and destroy the heir also. Thus they will extinguish my coal which is left, so as to leave my husband neither name nor remnant on the face of the earth. So she comes and she falls down before David, as is would have been protocol. And she says, help, O king, which also apparently was protocol. And David responds and says, what's the problem? And then she spells out this story. And the story is that she is a widow. She has only two children. They are both sons. And those sons went out into a field, and they got into a fight. There was no one there to break it up. The fight kind of got out of hand, and one of them killed the other. So the family now, this is the extended family now, is saying, your son killed your other son. Justice demands that your living son be put to death by us, by society. That's what the law requires. And it's interesting, the wording that of the family is, hand over the one who struck his brother, that we may put him to death for the life of his brother whom he killed, and destroy the heir also. So the woman's scenario is bringing to David's attention the fact that if her remaining son is killed, then there will be no one to inherit her husband's property. That will go over to the extended family. Suggesting that there may be a bit of a mixed motive on the part of the extended family in wanting to put to death her son. It may be that they're interested in justice, but there's also the possibility that they are interested in the property. They would like to redistribute that among the clan. And so that's why she's raising that issue. And what she's pointing out is, they will extinguish my coal which is left, and leave my husband neither name nor remnant on the face of the earth. And in the ancient cultures, to have someone to carry on the name was extremely important. To not have that is very dishonorable. It's disgraceful. So it was very important to her that the family be able to go on. And so in order for that to happen, her son has to survive this and not be put to death. Next section. Then the king said to the woman, go to your house, and I will give orders concerning you. And the woman of Tekoa said to the king, O my lord the king, the iniquity is on me and my father's house, but the king and his throne are guiltless. So the king said, whoever speaks to you, bring him to me, and he will not touch you anymore. Then she said, please let the king remember the Lord your God, so that the avenger of blood may not continue to destroy, lest they destroy my son. And he said, as the Lord lives, not one hair of your son shall fall to the ground. The woman is quite persistent here. And it's a little bit hard to figure out exactly what's going on between the lines, why it is that she feels like she needs to be persistent. But I think this is the way that it is going. David's response to her is, I have heard you, I'm interested in intervening in this case, and I will promise you that I will look into it and make a ruling. Her response seems to indicate that she thinks that David's reluctance to actually rule on it then and there is because he doesn't want the blood guilt to be on him for letting the murderer go free. So I think that's why she responds, O my lord the king, the iniquity is on me and my father's house, but the king and his throne are guiltless. In other words, if you let my son go, all the guilt will be on us. It won't be on you. And she seems to also be afraid for her own safety, that if the blood guilt's going to come on her, that the family might decide that she needs to be put to death. So David's response then is, whoever speaks to you, bring him to me, and he will not touch you anymore. So David is guaranteeing then that he will make sure that she is safe, that nobody touches her. Furthermore, it goes on to the next step. She comes back. She's still got another concern, and that is that her son will not be safe. Even if David has said, I guarantee your safety, she's still concerned, but what about my son? And David makes it specific. He says, as the Lord lives, not one hair of your son shall fall to the ground. So he's promising the safety of the son as well. So David ends up essentially saying, no, your son will not be held blame for this, will not be put to death for this. I promise also that you will be protected, and I promise that your son will be protected, and no harm will come to either of you. It is ironic here that David expresses himself by saying, not one hair of your son shall fall to the ground, as we get on later in the narrative. David's son's hair will end up falling to the ground. Next section. Then the woman said, please let your maidservant speak a word to my lord the king. And he said, speak. And the woman said, why then have you planned such a thing against the people of God? For in speaking this word, the king is as one who is guilty, in that the king does not bring back his banished one. For we shall surely die, and are like water spilled on the ground, which cannot be gathered up again. Yet God does not take away life, but plans ways, so that the banished one may not be cast out from him. Now the reason I have come to speak this word to my lord the king is because the people have made me afraid. So your maidservant said, let me now speak to the king. Perhaps the king will perform the request of his maidservant. For the king will hear and deliver his maidservant from the hand of the man who would destroy both me and my son from the inheritance of God. Then your maidservant said, please let the word of my lord the king be comforting. For as the angel of God, so is my lord the king to discern good and evil. And may the Lord your God be with you. So now she has told her story. She has elicited the responses from David that she needs up to this point. And now she makes it clear what the correlation is between her fictitious story and David's situation. And she's going to spell that out, and then apparently she's going to kind of back off and return to talking about her particular situation. So she begins by saying, let me speak a word to the Lord my King. He says, why then have you planned such a thing against the people of God? Apparently what she's suggesting is that by keeping Absalom in exile, that David is actually running the risk of endangering the whole nation of Israel. And this is apparently the concern that was shared by Joab, that it is possible that Absalom would put together an army outside of the boundaries of Israel and mount some kind of invasion or something along those lines. So she is accusing David of actually endangering the nation of Israel. For in speaking this word, the king is as one who is guilty in that the king does not bring back his banished one. In other words, by rendering the decision you just rendered in the case that I presented to you, you should be bringing back Absalom. Because they are one in the same. Now, how are they one in the same? I think what she would argue is, first of all, in both instances, the murder was not a premeditated murder. An unaggravated murder. In the case of the two struggling in the field, it wasn't premeditated. They were just fighting, and one of them accidentally died, I guess. In the other one, Absalom was responding to a wrong that had already occurred. So in neither case was it an unaggravated murder. In the other way in which they're the same is both of them have complications that are really apart from the murder itself, but they are kind of extenuating circumstances such that to carry out the punishment would do undue harm. The putting to death of Absalom would be difficult for the whole nation. We'll see that later plays itself out. The putting to death of the son that had killed the other would have destroyed the inheritance for that family. So I think what the woman is suggesting is that these murders have some similarities, and the judgment in one should be the same as the judgment in the other. And therefore, Absalom should be forgiven and be allowed to return. She goes on, "For we shall surely die and are like water spilled on the ground, which cannot be gathered up again." I think her point there is life's short. That there are a lot of things in the midst of life that loom large. But if you realize and you reflect on the fact that we're only here for a short period of time, are those all that big a deal? And when you take that perspective, it is amazing how much many things that we see as being very important in our lives shrink down in size. And I think she's suggesting that's exactly the case here. That whatever grievance you continue to have with Absalom, put it into perspective. Reflect on the fact that you're going to die before too long. Do you really want to leave things in the way that they stand right now? And then she goes on, a wonderful sentence. "Yet God does not take away life, but plans ways so that the banished one may not be cast out from him." And the comment here is, it is God's nature to not want to destroy. It is God's nature to not want to kill. In fact, he will go to great lengths to avoid having to do that. And the implication is, you ought also to do the same, David. Then, here's where she backtracks. She's made her point. She's made the correlation. She's scored the punch that she wanted to score. Now she's going to backtrack and kind of take the pressure off a little bit. It says, "Now the reason I have come to speak this word to my lord, the king, is because the people have made me afraid. So your maidservant said, 'Let me now speak to the king. Perhaps the king will perform the request of his maidservant.'" So she's backing off and saying, "I just came because I was afraid. And I thought that if I came to you, brought this matter to your attention, that I could get justice. For the king will hear and deliver his maidservant from the hand of the man who would destroy both me and my son from the inheritance of God." Then she says, "Let the word of my lord, the king, be comforting. For as the angel of God, so is my lord, the king, to discern good and evil." So she's praising him for his justice in this matter, seeing things clearly. This is ironic in light of what is going to come in the next few chapters, but we'll see that that's built on. And may the Lord your God be with you. Places her blessing on David as she concludes her comments. Okay, now David figures out what's going on, and he's going to respond to that. Verse 18. Then the king answered and said to the woman, "Please do not hide anything from me that I am about to ask you." And the woman said, "Let my lord the king please speak." So the king said, "Is the hand of Joab with you in all this?" And the woman answered and said, "As your soul lives, my lord the king, no one can turn to the right or to the left from anything that my lord the king has spoken. Indeed, it was your servant Joab who commanded me, and it was he who put all these words in the mouth of your maidservant. In order to change the appearance of things, your servant Joab has done this thing. But my lord is wise, like the wisdom of the angel of God, to know all that is in the earth." So David, no, he's figured out what's going on. So clearly this is an issue that Joab has brought before David probably a number of times. So as soon as David puts together the pieces, he knows that Joab's been involved in this. This has been a setup, and it has brought David to the point that Joab wanted to bring him to. So he says, "Joab involved in this?" And the woman says, "You know everything." Again, something that's ironic in light of what's going to come up in a couple of chapters. "You know everything. I don't know how anything could escape you. Yes, it was Joab that asked, put these words in my mouth, asked me to do this." And then she goes on to praise him. There's a statement here that's very interesting in verse 20. "In order to change the appearance of things, your servant Joab has done this thing." To change the appearance of things. I think the idea here is Joab knew that if he could get David to step back a little bit from the situation and look at it a little bit more dispassionately, a little bit more disinterestedly, that he would realize that the only thing that can be done here, the thing that needs to be done here, is to bring Absalom back and to be reconciled to him. So Joab just wanted to change the appearance of things. Let him see it from a different perspective, the same matter. Then she concludes, "But my Lord is wise, like the wisdom of the angel of God, to know all that is in the earth." That's the second time that she has used this phrase, the angel of God, with respect to David, likening him to that. Okay, next section. Then the king said to Joab, "Behold now, I will surely do this thing. Go, therefore, bring back the young man Absalom." And Joab fell on his face to the ground, prostrated himself, and blessed the king. Then Joab said, "Today your servant knows that I have found favor in your sight, O my lord, the king, in that the king has performed the request of his servant." So Joab arose and went to Geshur and brought Absalom to Jerusalem. However, the king said, "Let him turn to his own house and let him not see my face." So Absalom turned to his own house and did not see the king's face. Now in all Israel there was no one as handsome as Absalom, no so highly praised. From the sole of his foot to the crown of his head, there was no defect in him. And when he cut the hair of his head, and it was at the end of every year that he cut it, for it was heavy on him, so he cut it. He weighed the hair of his head at 200 shekels by the king's weight. And to Absalom there were born three sons and one daughter whose name was Tamar. She was a woman of beautiful appearance. So when this is all over, David doesn't rebuke Joab. He recognizes what has happened, but he sees this as the right course of action that Joab is advocating, and and is not upset. There's no indication that he's upset with Joab for the way that he has brought David to the point of recognizing this. So Joab is very thankful. He thanks David. He falls to the ground, prostrates himself before him, and expresses his gratitude. Then Joab takes off on his mission. He goes to Geshur, and he gets Absalom and brings him back to Jerusalem. Now, David is willing to have Absalom come back to Jerusalem, but David is not willing at this point for a full reconciliation. He has Absalom go to his house, which is apparently a separate building, or at least a separate part of the palace. And Absalom is not allowed to have an audience with the king at this point in time. So we've got Absalom's back, but we haven't got really reconciliation. The narrator takes a little break at this point to tell us a little bit about Absalom. Absalom is extremely handsome and highly praised, and I think that's apparently at least in part for his good looks, but it could be for other attributes as well. From the sole of his foot to the crown of his head, there was no defect in him. So he's a prime specimen. And he's hairy. He has so much hair that he is forced to cut it off at the end of every year because it's a burden to carry it around. I know the problem. And when it was cut off, its weight is 200 shekels. Now, it's hard to know how much that is because there are two different kinds of shekels. If it's the standard shekel, then it is approximately 6 pounds. If it's the royal shekel, it's approximately 3 pounds. But it's a lot of hair. That's a lot of hair. So he's got a lot of thick hair that grows really long. And a lot of hair was seen as being indicative of virility and manliness, so it would have been a desirable attribute. Absalom has 4 children mentioned here, 3 sons, none of which are named here, and they aren't named later in the account either. So in all probability, these 3 sons died young. He also had a daughter by the name, and he named it Tamar. Where did he get that name? Clearly, he's devoted to his sister, and it may be indicative that he's kind of keeping that memory of what happened alive. But his daughter was also a woman of beautiful appearance, so that whole family seems to be very nice looking. Okay, so it has stuck that little bit of information into the narrative about Absalom, because that's going to be significant later on. Now, Absalom lived 2 full years in Jerusalem and did not see the king's face. Then Absalom sent for Joab to send him to the king, but he would not come to him. So he sent again a second time, but he would not come. Therefore, he said to his servants, "See, Joab's field is next to mine, and he has barley there. Go and set it on fire." So Absalom's servants set the field on fire. Then Joab arose, came to Absalom at his house, and said to him, "Why have your servants set my field on fire?" And Absalom answered Joab, "Behold, I sent for you, saying, 'Come here, that I may send you to the king, to say, why have I come from Geshur? It would have been better for me still to be there. Now, therefore, let me see the king's face. And if there is iniquity in me, let him put me to death.' So when Joab came to the king and told him, he called for Absalom. Thus he came to the king and prostrated himself on his face to the ground before the king. And the king kissed Absalom." So Absalom has been back in Jerusalem 2 full years now, and has yet to see the king, his father. So they have not been reconciled for all of this time. And Absalom is getting frustrated. He wants action. He wants this to be resolved. And he can't get an audience with the king. So he appeals to Joab. Joab's the one who went to Geshur and brought him back. He appeals to Joab and he says, would you arrange an audience with the king for me? And Joab doesn't respond. So Absalom asks Joab again. No response. So Absalom's not sure what to do, and not being one who can refrain from action, Absalom decides, I'm gonna force things. I'm going to make this happen. So he tells his servants, light Joab's field on fire. And he got the response he wanted, because Joab comes to Absalom and says, what are you doing? And Absalom says, well, it makes all kinds of sense to me. You wouldn't respond, so I burned your field, and now you're here, and you're going to listen to what I have to say. And his concern is, what his complaint, the thing that's been eating at him, is if David is not going to reconcile himself with his son, then Absalom would have preferred to stay back in Geshur. Either let me stay in Geshur and be in exile, or let me be reconciled, but don't make me stay here in limbo, being neither. And he says, tell David that if he wants to kill me, kill me. Otherwise, let me be reconciled to him. Those are the options. This limbo stuff doesn't work for me. So Joab reports that to the king, and at this point in time, David is willing to be reconciled. And Absalom comes before him, and David kisses Absalom, and apparently reconciliation has taken place. But as we'll see, there's a sense in which this is too late. Absalom has developed an animosity towards David that's not easily done away with at this point. The first part of chapter 15. Now it came about after this that Absalom provided for himself a chariot and horses and 50 men as runners before him. And Absalom used to rise early and stand beside the way to the gate. And it happened that when any man had a suit to come to the king for judgment, Absalom would call to him and say, from what city are you? And he would say, your servant is from one of the tribes of Israel. Then Absalom would say to him, see, your claims are good and right, but no man listens to you on the part of the king. Moreover, Absalom would say, oh, that one would appoint me judge in the land. Then every man who has any suit or cause could come to me, and I would give him justice. And it happened that when a man came near to prostrate himself before him, he would put out his hand and take hold of him and kiss him. And in this manner Absalom dealt with all Israel who came to the king for judgment. So Absalom stole away the hearts of the men of Israel. Absalom is truly a man of action. He's always got a plan. He knows what needs to be done to accomplish the purpose that he wants to accomplish. So he's got a plan now of what he's going to do. The first thing he does is he buys himself a chariot. Up to this point, there has been no mention of any of the kings of Israel having a chariot. So a chariot, but other kings in other areas would have had chariots. And this would be a status symbol. And a status symbol that shows that he is the kind of person that could be king. And with the chariot, he's got horses. And horses, again, are another status symbol. You need the horses for the chariots. And the horses were a symbol of power throughout the area. All of the other kings would have had horses. And he has 50 men as runners before him. So an entourage that also shows his significance and his power. If you will recall, in the Law of Moses, it said that you will have a king one day when you get into the land. But it said your kings are not to multiply horses. The kings were not to have a lot of horses. They weren't to multiply wives either. And there were other provisions as well. But they were to be dependent on God for their security and not on the things that other ways of securing themselves and their power. So Absalom is stepping outside of what God had commanded in the Mosaic Law. So having bought a chariot and got these horses and this entourage of runners that go before him, now he's developed this practice where he gets up early in the morning and he goes down in front of the city gate. The city gate is where business is done. The city gate is where important stuff is taken care of, governmental as well as private. And he's stationed himself just outside of the city gate. And anybody who comes in, he carries on a little dialogue with them. He starts out by asking, "Where'd you come from?" A little chit-chat, getting to know them. And they respond, "Well, I'm from part of Israel." Well, that's the answer that he wants. Because what he wants to raise, the question that he wants to raise is, are you, as an Israelite, being served well by the king and his government? So he asks them where they're from. They say from one of the tribes of Israel. Then Absalom would say, "See, your claims are good and right." There's no indication that he's heard what these claims are. He just knows they're good and right. "See, your claims are good and right, but no man listens to you on the part of the king." So what he's doing is saying, whatever your cause is, I'm for it. I'm on your side. And it's too bad that in this country you can't get a just response from your government. So he's arousing a sense of discontent with the existing state of things. He goes on, he has a suggestion. He goes on, "Oh, that one would appoint me judge in the land. Then every man who has any suit or cause could come to me, and I would give him justice." So if I were just in a position to judge, I would give justice. It's too bad that you can't get it from the existing kingdom. But I would give it. Then very interesting, and then whoever he was talking to typically would come near and prostrate and bow down before him and put out his hand, and Absalom would take hold of him and kiss him. The verb that's used here is the same verb that was used with respect to Amnon when he reached out to Tamar and took hold of her. Now, it could be coincidence, but there are some similarities here in the way that Amnon wanted to abuse Tamar, Absalom is abusing the people of Israel. Okay, one more section. "Now it came about at the end of 40 years that Absalom said to the king, 'Please let me go and pay my vow which I have vowed to the Lord in Hebron. For your servant vowed a vow while I was living in Geshur in Aram, saying, if the Lord shall indeed bring me back to Jerusalem, then I will serve the Lord.' And the king said to him, 'Go in peace.' So he arose and went to Hebron. But Absalom sent spies throughout all the tribes of Israel, saying, "As soon as you hear the sound of the trumpet, then you shall say, 'Absalom is king in Hebron.'" Then 200 men went with Absalom from Jerusalem, who were invited and went innocently. And they did not know anything. And Absalom sent for Ahithophel, the Gilonite, David's counselor, from his city Gilo, while he was offering the sacrifices. And the conspiracy was strong, for the people increased continually with Absalom. It says, now it came about at the end of 40 years that Absalom said to the king, there's no way that that 40 can be right. People have tried all kinds of ways to make sense of that, and it's hard to find a point from which 40 years could be counted that would make sense in this context. In all probability, it's much more likely that it's 4 would have been the number. That fits in well with the narrative. It makes a lot of sense, and so that's probably the case. If that's true, then it's after 4 years of this kind of campaigning. So he was in Geshur for 2 years. Then he was in Jerusalem, but unreconciled for another 2 years. And now it's another 4 years after that. So it's 8 years since the rape occurred that these events are occurring. So Absalom goes to David and he says, "I took an oath when I was in Geshur that I would offer sacrifices to God and that I would do that in Hebron. Please allow me to go and fulfill the vow that I had made. Let me go to Hebron and do that." And David says, "Fine, go ahead and do that." There is precedence in the ancient world that 7 years is the period of time that one is banished for manslaughter. And so it could be that there's something along those lines is what's happening here, that the 7 years is up and he is going to offer the sacrifice. But the reality is that's a sham. That's not the primary reason for going to Hebron. He wants to get out of Jerusalem so that he can put together a rebellion against the King David. And he has orchestrated it so that he has messengers that are going out to each of the tribes. They know when the right time is, and when the right time comes, they will blow their horns and proclaim that Absalom is king in Hebron, that he's now king, he has taken over, and encourage people to rise up on his behalf and overthrow David, Absalom's father. Absalom has taken with him 200 men. These are probably administrators from Jerusalem, at least some of them, if not all of them. These 200 men are not a part of this plot. But by taking these 200 men with him, he has greatly reduced David's ability to respond to what's happening. So this is a clever stratagem on his part. He's mounting this rebellion elsewhere. He has made it harder for David to respond to this uprising and made it possible for him to gather together his forces outside of Jerusalem and then march on Jerusalem when the time is right. One of the people that is cooperating with Absalom in this uprising is Ahithophel. Ahithophel was one of David's key advisors. And he was very, very intelligent. And there's some indication that his participation in the rebellion was particularly hurtful to David. The last sentence, "And the conspiracy was strong, for the people increased continually with Absalom." Absalom had done a great job campaigning and was able to win over a large number of people to his side, and so he's able to mount this rebellion that has quite a bit of backing. Okay, there are there's one main thing that I would like to talk about, and this is the more I read the Old Testament narratives, the more impressed I get with the way they're constructed. They are very cleverly put together, and as I was thinking about this passage and reflecting on what's going on here, it struck me again how well constructed these narratives are. Let's look back at chapter 13, the last three verses, starting with verse 37. I want to go through these because they're put together in a way that is very clever for what I think the author is trying to do. And let me tell you what I think the author is trying to do. What David seems to be wrestling with from here until and for most of the rest of 2 Samuel is this issue of when do you punish and when do you be merciful? That David is recognizing, and everybody needs to recognize, that if there is a standard of right and wrong, that it makes all kinds of sense that when there are violations of that standard of right, that there be punishment that accompany that. And it has to accompany that on a regular basis, because that's what makes it valuable. That's what communicates to people that doing what is right is important. But if one has been forgiven much, if one has been the beneficiary of much mercy, it's difficult to be a judge and say, but you are going to be punished. I was forgiven, but in your case, punishment is necessary. It's hard to do that. If you've been forgiven much, it's hard not to want to forgive everyone for what they've done. So David is caught in this tension between when do you extend mercy and when do you punish? And I think that's reflected in the narrative. Verse 37, at the end of chapter 13, it says, "Now Absalom fled and went to Talmai, the son of Amihud, the king of Geshur. And David mourned for his son every day." It doesn't tell you which son. You have to look at this for a long time to try to sort it out, because it could be either son. Which one is he mourning? It goes on. "So Absalom had fled and gone to Geshur and was there 3 years. And the heart of David longed to go out to Absalom." The Hebrew for that is ambiguous. In my text, it has "the heart of" in italics. All it says is David longed to go out to or for Absalom. So it's not clear whether he wants to go out, reach out, or whether he wants to go get him and bring him back. Then it goes on, "For he was comforted concerning Amnon since he was dead." So the author has, in two occasions here, has used ambiguous language to confuse us as to what are his feelings with respect to each of these sons. It goes on. In verse 1 of 14, "Now Joab the son of Zeruiah perceived that the king's heart," and then I have in italics, "was inclined toward Absalom." All it says is just the preposition "all," which could either mean to or against. It can either be positive or it could be negative with respect to Absalom. So as you're reading through it, at each one of these points, it's kind of sticky. And you go, well, what's David thinking? And when you put it all together, the impression that you're left is David doesn't know what to think. David is of two minds all the way through this. And I think that's why the language is ambiguous as we go through it. that the author is trying to clue us in. David is struggling. David is trying to figure out when Amnon raped Tamar, it says David was angry, but David didn't act. And I think the reason is he's struggling. Is punishment appropriate here, or is mercy appropriate here? And apparently he chose mercy because he had just been the recipient of such mercy in a similar kind of occasion. Now Absalom kills Amnon, and David is upset about that. And Absalom flees, and David doesn't bring him back right away. I think David is really upset with Absalom. I think he's angry with Absalom. But he doesn't really know what to do. And so it isn't until Joab comes along and coaxes him to look at it a little differently that he brings Absalom back. But he still doesn't know quite what to do. And then finally is forced, put in a situation where he reconciles with Absalom fully. I think that's a fascinating tension, and one that I think every parent experiences, probably anyone in a position of authority experiences. When do you punish, and when do you extend mercy? If you extend mercy all of the time, it ceases to be mercy. It's just the thing that is done. It loses all significance and all value. But on the other hand, to punish always, regardless of the circumstances, is not to recognize the nature of human beings. And it's not to recognize that we too are sinners and capable of the same thing. And I think that what we'll see is David struggles with this all the rest of the way through the book. There is no answer that's given, I don't think. It may be that as we get further on, we'll see an answer, but my suspicion is that we won't. Because I don't think that there is a calculus that one can apply to decide when is punishment appropriate and when is mercy appropriate. It's just something that we have to use judgment and wrestle with as we go along. And I think that's exactly what David is doing. The other thing that I will point out is what Absalom is doing here, his politicking, is a tried and true method. It's been used by politicians for ages. It will continue to be used for ages to come, if we have ages to come. That what he's doing is, first of all, arousing discontent. And I'm convinced that the easiest response to get from human beings is discontent. We're always willing to go there. And the other thing that he's doing is assuring them, whatever your cause is, I'm for it. I'm on your side. I support whatever cause you support. And the people go along. The people go along. They are seduced by him because they're seducible. And that's going to lead to David being chased out of Jerusalem by the people of Israel. Okay. Any questions or comments?
Do you think the story that Joab sends with the woman, that's a fair story, that it's an accurate comparison with the situation? Or is he manipulating?
Well, I think that it is... I think that it does have the two points of analogy that I think are important. One is that it is aggravated murder in both cases. And the other is that there are extenuating circumstances in both cases that need to be taken into account. So they don't match exactly, and I think for Joab's purposes it'd be important that they not match exactly. He needs to be different enough that David doesn't realize right up front what's going on. But it has to be close enough that David will look at his relationship with his situation with Absalom through different eyes. And I think it is close enough to accomplish those purposes.
I'm just wondering what David was doing during these 4 years. Is he really ruling and aware of what's going on, that his son is building up this army? Or is he somehow not even being, you know, a wise king during that time?
That's what's ironic about the woman's comments, where she says that you know everything that's going on, because there is a rebellion brewing right under his nose and he's not aware of it. It's not clear to me whether David is being negligent or whether he's being trusting. And I think at this point David's getting along in years. There are several indications that David is getting along in years, and that may be playing a part as well, that he's just not as active as he had been earlier. But this question, it is a good question, it's an important question. Is David a good king, a responsible king? There are some commentators who talk about, who basically look at the way that he treats Amnon without taking action as being irresponsible, and the way that he deals with Absalom as being irresponsible, here that we've read already, being oblivious to the plot that's brewing as being irresponsible. And it's possible that that's the way we should see it. At this point, I'm not inclined to see it that way. I think that his experience with Bathsheba was very humbling, and it may have caused him to kind of withdraw a bit. That's very possible. But as far as being actually irresponsible, I don't think we should see it that way. I think it's more likely that he's being trusting.
The comment you just made about his failure with Bathsheba humbling him, it almost is, as I read through this, it almost sounds like it just broke his heart. It shattered his spirit to where he didn't even want to be king, which was really not, he started out enthusiastic, faithful, devoted. It's like, I'll take on Goliath. He was just sort of this exuberant, almost naive, faithful follower of God, and then he gets up into a position of power, and he never loses. Kingdoms fall before him. He wins all his battles. Everything's really great, and then all of a sudden, he finds out he's just a man. And I've been to Jerusalem. The old city of Jerusalem is a very small place. It is absolutely impossible to not know Absalom sitting out there at the gate, schmoozing with people. And no king and no military leader has no intelligence network in his own kingdom. He had to know what was going on. Unless he was, as I read history, he'd have to be really daft to not be aware. And then, it's the rapes, the murders. I think he was just so broken down that it almost feels like he'd rather be anywhere else but king. And so, is he possibly living under his commission to be king? It's become a burden. He'd rather go back and tend the flocks. It sort of sounds like an interpretive Hollywood film of David's life. But the results that he doesn't even have the confidence to enforce the law that he claims to love so well. It reminds me of the great warriors in history who, once they're defeated in battle, they go off and they become a monk because their fire's gone out of them, kind of a thing.
Yeah, it's a little hard to know exactly how to put all the pieces together. I think it is true. I think it's pretty clear from the narrative that something changes after his adultery of Bathsheba. That something does change significantly, and I think that David is kind of broken by that in a way that you don't see before. But it is important to note that things were not all wonderful before Bathsheba. There are some commentators who kind of describe David's life, like everything is wonderful until Bathsheba, and then everything is downhill. Well, the narrative really doesn't support that, because David suffered a lot prior to Bathsheba. Life was tough, and it was hard. He certainly, under Saul, he suffered a great deal. But there is something that changes after Bathsheba. I think that's clear. And what's the nature of that? And I think the nature of that is David is feeling kind of broken down. I guess that's the best way to put it. But my guess is that anyone who has lived long enough gets to the place where they feel kind of broken down. Life just beats up people. And I don't think it's possible to say have the same kind of idealism and exuberance when you're 60 or 65 that you had when you were 25 or 30. I can't. And I was exuberant when I was 25 or 30. But life just has a way of... I mean, there are some... Sometimes they're knockout blows, but mostly it's body blows. It's a lot of body blows. And life just has its way of taking toll on a person. And I think David is broken down. And just as an example, I mean, we have four children. Our first four were raised very differently than our fourth one. And part of that is, by the time you get to the fourth one, you're just tired. you don't want to take on every little thing. And I think that David's experiencing a similar kind of thing. And he's to the place now in later in life when Amnon rapes Tamar and he is angry. And I think he doesn't quite know what to do about it, but he's also tired. And Absalom, he doesn't want to take steps to reconcile with Absalom, but he doesn't quite know what to do, and he's tired. And I think that's kind of the picture that emerges. But as far as being negligent, I'm reluctant to go there unless I see more in the text that would point me in that direction.
Thank you very much. It took me a while to figure out who Joab was. I mean, he just kind of seems to come in verse 1 of 14, just kind of out of the blue. I don't know. Maybe he was in there before and I didn't remember. Uh-huh. But anyway, I'm looking at verse 7 and 14, and... the woman had been telling David about her own family situation. Mm-hmm. So then it looks like she's saying, "Okay, now we should kill my son who killed my other son." Is that right?
Yes. What happened? The two sons fought. And one son killed the other one. So the living son is guilty of murdering the other one. And so, strictly speaking, he should be punished. And I'm put to death is probably the right sentence. And what she's saying is, and the extended family is insisting that that penalty be carried out, that my only remaining son be put to death as a penalty for having killed my other son. And that's what she's appealing and saying. Under the circumstances, that would be a bad judgment to enact. And that's what she's appealing then to David.
So she doesn't want him killed.
She doesn't want him killed.
Okay. I couldn't figure that out. Thank you.
And Joab is, let's see, David's uncle? or David's nephew. I can't remember which way it goes. But he's related to David through one of David's brothers. And he's been with David going way back to when David fled Saul and went to Philistia and then later went to Judea. So he's been with him all along. Joab is probably his most trusted advisor and a general of the army.
Mm-hmm. It seems like as experienced as a parent and looking at our justice system that it isn't necessarily a situation where you have to show either punishment or mercy in a particular case. It seems to me that sometimes you can show both at the same time. And I was just wondering what's your comment on that. It seems sometimes, you know, on a parent, if we have certain rules or for certain actions or whatever, certain consequences, that after the third or fourth one or whatever, instead of the full punishment, it's on, you know, you adjust it or whatever. Mm-hmm. And sure. It seems like, you know, even in our own justice system, that especially when they make deals with a person who has gone against the law, that, you know, will give you a break, you know, if you, in other words, we're going to punish you, but we'll show you mercy by giving you a break in less time or whatever. Mm-hmm. It seems like possibly David could have punished Absalom anything short of putting him to death while at the same time showing mercy.
Right, right. Certainly that can be. I think that it's important that punishment always be done with respect. That is to say, that punishment be carried out in a way that shows humility on the part of those administering the punishment. And that's important, I think, as parents and as bosses and in any capacity where punishment is administered, that it's important to do it humanely and with respect. I would argue, I think the death penalty makes sense. I'm in favor of a death penalty. But I think even the death penalty needs to be carried out with respect. And I think it can be. So that's across the board. The punishment always needs to be done in a way that is done with respect. Mercy, then, can be a part of the way that one deals with someone who has violated the law. And it can be full mercy or it can be partial mercy. Partial mercy is still mercy. And I think that what David is struggling with is what would be the appropriate combination, what would be the appropriate solution in each of these circumstances. And with Absalom, I think having him come back but not reconciling with him was one of his attempts to be somewhat merciful, but still there's a punishment involved. But I think what he decides later is that that's not working.
As Absalom's sitting outside of the city gates, the people that are coming to him, are they eventually getting to David, or are they believing Absalom and turning around?
Presumably, they're pursuing their case through government channels and getting some kind of response, presumably.
And yet that's still breeding discontent in their hearts because...
Well, my guess is that not all of them get the judgment that they want. So what Absalom has done is he has suggested, I would judge in your favor. I would give good justice. I'd get the kind of justice that you would recognize as justice. Anything else? Okay, thanks.